Der Peter-Podcast. Willkommen zurück zum Peter-Podcast. Ich bin Gesine Kühne und ich freue mich, dass ich euch über 9 Folgen Podcast mit großer Hilfe von Jobst Eggert einen Einblick in die Arbeit von Peter Deutschland geben konnte. Danke an alle Mitarbeiter, die sich meinen Fragen gestellt haben und auch danke an alle anderen Freunde und Bekannte, die sich für Tierrechte einsetzen, denen ich dann ebenfalls das Mikro unter die Nase halten durfte. Nun zu dieser 10. Folge. Ich habe es ja bereits angekündigt. Es ist eine ganz besondere Folge. Denn ich habe vor einiger Zeit Ingrid Newkirk getroffen. Die Mitbegründerin von Peter war in Deutschland und ich habe die Chance genutzt, sie auszufragen. Wir saßen eine Stunde zusammen und Ingrid erzählte mir aus ihrem Leben. Als Kind hat sie schon so viel erlebt, das hat sie auf jeden Fall so sehr geprägt, dass es für sie klar war, dass sie sich im Leben für Schwächere einsetzen muss. Wie daraus dann Tierschutz und Tierrechte wurden, das hört ihr am besten selbst. Hallo Ingrid.
Hello there.
You were born in England, but you grew up in India, New Delhi, I read. How did you get there?
Oh, I was born in England. Then when I was about 7, my father went to help the Indian government because they expected a war with China. And my father designed bombing systems. So off we went, and we lived in New Delhi, but it was too hot, and there was too much of a social life with adults for little girls. So I went off to a boarding school in the Himalayas, in the everlasting snows. And that's where I was for 8 years, I suppose, until I went back to England.
I find it quite interesting. So you weren't as long in India, but in the Himalayas for boarding school. Did this experience have a lot of influence in you and how you became a strong woman that you are today?
I was probably born a strong woman because I was a precocious child. I was born 10 pounds of weight. And I think the first thing I did was pull my mummy's necklace off her neck and break it. So I'm not someone you mess with, but it did have a profound effect. Because one thing I know that happened is the Indian poet and philosopher Rabindranath Tagore sent one of his disciples to our school. And we were snobbish little English girls, and we were given our comeuppance because this disciple reprimanded us and said, there are more important things in life than clothes and pop records and boys and so on. You need to look around you at nature, at the beauty of the world, the natural world, and think about the plants and the human beings who are just grubbing an existence, who weren't born as privileged as you. Look at the animals who live on the earth with you. And at the time, we thought that was very funny, because that's not what we were taught. But later on, that resonated with me, and my heart opened to those things, so I am very grateful that he came to visit us in our school.
I thought the holy cow might have been also something that resonated, something in the subconsciousness maybe.
Well, the holy cow did resonate with me in a very firm way. When I was about 9, I was home from the holidays, and I was sitting at my dining room table, which had a big glass window, looking out on a busy road. And in those days, you had traffic, mechanized vehicles, but you also had bullock carts, a cattle pulling these heavy loads around the streets. And as I was drinking my soup, I saw this man pick up a heavy stick and start beating this bullock who was slow. He had something wrong with him. He couldn't move. And the bullock fell down. And as I watched, the man jumped from the cart, picked up the bullock's tail and rammed the stick up inside him. And I dropped my soup spoon and I ran out to the road and I grabbed that stick from him. I was only 9 And I think I would have broken that man's back if somebody hadn't stopped me, because I was so angry that he was hurting this bellowing, ill, collapsed animal. But that always meant a lot to me, and my mother and I would rescue bulls and cows who were abandoned by the roadside.
Mm. Those are already incidents or happenings that can definitely shape a child, for sure. Was that definitely like your initial thought of becoming someone who speaks up for the weaker?
Well, my mother was a great leader because she devoted all her time to unwed mothers who were cast out of the house in India and had their babies on the street, and to lepers and to orphans. And so when I was home for the holidays, we would troop around to orphanages and shelters for homeless women and so on. And she always said to me, it doesn't matter who suffers, it matters that they suffer. So our house was always full of refugees, humans, dogs. There was even a mongoose at one time who was ill. And she always said, look out for them. So that's what I grew up with. And when I was in India, because the cruelty is in front of you, it's not hidden away the way it was in England or in Europe, I could see it. And I always said, when I grow up, I'm coming back to India and I'm going to start a group to help animals. But when I went back to England, I was a teenager and I forgot. So for some years, I put it behind me. But now I'm happy we're there.
And back in England, you were a teenager, so you still had to go to school. Was that the time where you had the Irish nuns I read about?
Oh, no, that was in India.
Okay.
The Irish nuns were in the convent in India.
Okay. So you did have India as a very truthful mirror of society. You had your parents who were doing so much good, so they were a good influence on you. When was the time that you realized this piece of meat on my plate was actually a cute little animal?
I'm ashamed to say it took me some years, because even though I had good friends in India who were vegetarian, it was just considered some religious thing that wasn't us. And in fact, my parents paid on the black market for beef, because you could always get it, but you had to pay under the table. But when I came to America, I was 20, and I went out on a cruelty case. I was a deputy sheriff. And there was a farm. The people had moved away from the farm and they had left all the animals behind. The horses were all dead in their stalls. And the people had had a drinks party before they left and smashed all the bottles. So the horses had been cut up before they died of starvation and dehydration. There was one little pig who is still alive. And I pulled him out of the barn and held him in my hands and took him to the water pump and was able to hold his head up and make water in the palm of my hands, cup it and let him drink. He made these little groaning, appreciative sounds. Then I called for somebody to take him to the veterinarian. That night, when I knew I had to prosecute these people for cruelty to animals, they were going to go to jail if I found them, I was wondering, because I was very hungry, what I had to eat at home. And it was before you had microwave ovens, and I thought, oh good, I defrosted those pork chops. And for some reason, your brain puts two and two together suddenly, and I thought, wait a minute, I'm prosecuting these people for cruelty to one little pig. But I know, even though then I had never been in a slaughterhouse, I have now, but I knew that a slaughterhouse must be a terribly frightening, bloody, smelly place, and an awful place where terrible things happen to animals. And suddenly I thought, I have paid somebody else to be cruel to another pig, and I'm going to eat his flesh. So at that moment I knew I'm not going to eat any more animals.
How did you get to the USA? I mean, you still were European, weren't you?
Yes, and I still am. I came with my father first. He was also working on a bombing contract for the Vietnam War.
Again.
And so we lived near a military base in Florida. And there I met the man I married, later divorced, but we were always great friends. And he lived in Washington, D.C. So I ended up for a period of time in Washington, D.C., and I just stayed there.
Mm. You started studying and you started working as the deputy sheriff, or?
What happened is when I moved to Washington, D.C., there were all these cats everywhere, and some of them had kittens inside my Volkswagen bus. And I had to take them to a shelter. So I thought a shelter would be a beautiful place where everybody cared for animals. Had no other idea, so I took them there and I found out it was an awful, filthy place. People were very rough with the animals and so on. And I was so upset because I had only seen cruelty in India on the streets. I had no idea that in America, in Europe, there was cruelty. This sounds fantastic, but I didn't, because it's not in front of you. But I saw it in that dirty shelter, and I immediately resigned my job. I was studying for the brokerage, stock brokerage, and asked them if I could fill the vacancy cleaning the kennel. They had an opening, and they said, "No, you're overqualified." Which is a term I've never understood. How can you ever be overqualified for anything? So I begged them, and they gave me the job. And that's how I started working for animals. And bit by bit, I had to take law enforcement training, so I became a deputy sheriff to do that, so I could prosecute cruelty to animals cases.
Mm. It's actually quite impressive that there is some deputy in the law enforcement that goes against animal cruelty. That's actually something that sounds pretty future, but it was only in the 70s. How can I imagine this whole job? How did your day look like back then?
Well, when I started in the kennel, it was cleaning. And there were men in the kennel who were very rough with the animals. And we got into fights because, for example, one day a man was pulling a Doberman out of a kennel and he wanted to dominate. He wanted to be the one in charge of this strong dog. And so he was very rough. And I actually ended up hitting him because he wouldn't stop. So I got a little bit of a reputation and they were afraid to be cruel to animals around me. Then they had euthanasia because in the US, the overpopulation of dogs is rampant. There are far, far many more animals than you can find homes, decent homes. And their method of euthanasia was very cruel. They used dull needles. They basically jabbed them in the vicinity of the heart. And I thought, this can't be right. It's too cruel. So I went to England and I studied how to do it humanely and came back. And I blew the whistle on them, and the whole Humane Society or animal shelter had to change. And from then I thought, we need to prosecute cruelty. So I became a law enforcement officer and then took cruelty cases and prosecuted them. And then one day I was offered the job of the pound master, which is a very old title. It means the man who runs the dog pound in Washington, D.C. And I thought this is a wonderful opportunity because that was a terrible place. So I went there, cleaned it up, put a spay neuter clinic in place, stopped the animals going to experimentation, and from there started PETA.
Washington, D.C., District of Columbia, we know what's happening there usually. Was that also already something in like a political sense, or did you get any, I don't know, feedback from the White House?
Actually, yes, because the government then there were a number of people running for the mayor. And I asked each one, what will you do for animals? And only one said, I will help you clean up the DC dog pound, which was in a mess. And so I went out on the road and I campaigned for him. That was Mayor Marion Barry, who was the first black mayor of the District of Columbia. I went door to door for him, and he made good on his promise. He won the election, and when he did, he gave me a budget, and he allowed me to do progressive things there, like start a sterilization program, like put in rules for adoption, so that people who were taking dogs away to be guard dogs, to guard their junkyards, to use for bad purposes for breeding, stopped. And so it was wonderful. But yes, it was very political. And one day we got a call from the White House because they had a wild turkey in a tree on the lawn in the front, and they didn't know what to do. And the Secret Service wanted to shoot the turkey, and I said, no, you can't. You have to wait and see what the turkey does. And in 2 days, the turkey flew away.
I really like those cute little anecdotes because they're so important, I think, in the whole animal concept. So people understand and actually, like, these are the stories where they can relate and they, like, get those heart heart movements, you know, when they, you come with the slaughterhouse, they're all like, I don't want to hear about that. Very cute. 1980. PETA was founded, but you didn't do it by yourself. How did the whole thing happen? I mean, today it's a huge organization, but I guess it started quite little.
Yes, I was running the DC Dog Pound, and one day a young man came in, and he said to me, oh, you're putting condensed milk in your tea. I always had tea in the morning. And I said, of course. And he said, well, do you eat veal? And I said, of course not, I don't eat veal. He said, well, do you realize that the reason you have condensed milk is because they had to do something with the calf who was going to drink that milk, and so they created a veal industry so they could sell the milk that was meant for him. And it had never occurred to me before. I was horrified because I was already a vegetarian, and I thought, drinking milk doesn't kill the cows. And he said, do you think there are retirement homes for these cows? And I thought, what kind of idiot am I that I've never thought about this? So that was the end of the milk in the tea. And then he said, what about your shoes? And I said, what about my shoes? And he told me, well, leather is a huge part of the meat industry, so they're making more money that way. You're helping support the meat industry. So anyway, I had learned all these different things. I had inspected laboratories in my job. I had been on farms in my job. And I had seen the overpopulation crisis for dogs and cats and bad homes for them and people beating and shooting them. So I knew a lot of things the average person doesn't see with animals. And I thought, we need to start a little group and just tell people their choices. So if they're going to eat a meat sandwich, they're going to have some milk in their tea, they're going to buy leather shoes or a shampoo that's tested on animals, I can say, wait a minute, don't you love animals? Don't you care about them? Here are some choices. So that was the idea behind forming PETA. And there were five people all together who worked with me, and together we formed People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals in my basement.
So, 1980, this was already 38 years ago, quite some time, and I have a feeling, I can't remember because I was born 78, that those times were still quite backwards, and people really hard to reach. How did you proceed, and what were your biggest wins as PETA?
Well, nobody had heard the word vegan. And it was quite unusual to be vegetarian. And people aspired to grow up and wear a fur coat. This was all normal. We had President Reagan's inauguration in Washington, D.C., and we made a big banner. It was from a Frank Sinatra song, but we changed the lyrics. So it said, "Take back your mink, take back your pearls. What makes you think I'm one of those girls?" And then it talked about animal rights, respecting animals, not taking from them to wear or to eat. And the television crews, national crews, came through in the inauguration. They saw our banner, which was red, white, and blue with American stars and stripes. And they thought, oh, what a beautiful patriotic banner. And a very famous TV broadcaster pointed to the banner live on national television and started to say the lyrics and then realized, what is this? It's about not hurting animals. And that put us on the map. The second thing that put us on the map is we went undercover for the first time ever in the US inside a laboratory where they were experimenting on macaque monkeys, cutting their spines, making their arms useless, and then electric shocking them so they would have to feed themselves through pain by picking raisins out of a dish. And we went to the Washington Post, the national newspaper. We went to the press, and we went to the police. And for the first time ever, a search warrant was served, and the monkeys were taken out of the lab. And we got sacks and sacks of mail from people saying, "I never knew anyone could do anything to help animals in laboratories. What can I do to help?" The magic words, "What can I do to help?" So we told them everything, not just in laboratories, but every single thing you can do is open your eyes, open your heart, open your mind, and see all the choices that you can make. It will make a big difference. And that was the beginning.
How did you get into the lab undercover? That sounds like almost like a crime novel content.
It's a fascinating story, and it has been made into a book. And in fact, somebody wants to make it into a film, but they haven't yet. But the man I was working with walked over to the laboratory nearest my apartment and said, "I'd like to have a job here, doing anything." And they said, "We haven't got a job." He said, "Okay, I'll volunteer." And they said, "Come in, fine. You can help us." So we didn't have hidden cameras then. We didn't have hidden movies or anything. He just had a hand camera in his pocket. And I would stay outside in the car, inside a cardboard box with a hole in it and a walkie-talkie, so that if anybody came at night to the lab, I would be able to tell him to put his camera away. And so he photographed everything inside, and we took it to experts, primatologists, psychologists, everybody, veterinarians, and they all said, "This is outrageous. This is disgusting. It shouldn't happen." And we had scientists look at what this experimenter was doing. He had no medical credentials at all, and yet he was operating on the monkeys. Mm. There was a big barrel full of dead bodies of monkeys that he had killed with gangrene and what have you. And so when we took it to the police, we were able to get a search warrant and raid the laboratory.
I'm going to jump from decade to decade, and you can add whatever you need to add. I have a feeling that the 90s were a bit more liberal, but maybe that's just my thinking because that was my teenage years and I had a sense of the world all of a sudden. Did it get easier with the 90s?
It got easier and it got harder. It got easier in that the more you talk to people, the more you give out leaflets and the more you get into the press, the more people hear about it. So from oblivion, we came to slow realization and then faster realization. But what became difficult is at some point, television shows in the US and radio shows in the US became monopolies. And they stopped asking serious questions. everything became a soundbite. Everything became about sex or violence or controversy in a quick way. And so all the opportunity to put your philosophical points about animal rights vanished almost overnight. But already we had managed to get people to see that fur was nothing to aspire to. It was something to reject. And gradually, young people started to acquire a more animal rights protectionist perspective. So that was good. And then, of course, eventually, when the internet came in, bam, everything changed. And suddenly, we could reach not a couple of hundred people in the town square with leaflets and a demonstration, but millions of people. So that was wonderful.
Mm. I actually have this in my notes, the 90s brought the internet and how did you communicate before? But of course, leaflets, you had to hand them out, right?
And use the telephone, which now we have to explain to people what that black box is on the desk. We had no fax machines, no portable telephones, no telephone answering machines, no computers in the beginning, and certainly no internet. So everything was done by the telephone, and who you called had to be there.
The 90s were, of course, a win with the internet to reach so many people. But the internet is evil. The internet is full of trolls. How did Peter react, or you, with all this vicious things that were written or said about you or the organization, because all of a sudden it was everywhere too?
Well, it's not the internet, unfortunately, it's people. So you have people who are kind and people who are cruel and people who take advantage and people who just like to hate. And unfortunately, it's shown us how many people are miserable human beings. But our challenge is always to counteract their viciousness, to get the facts out, to get the truth out, to appeal to people's better side, better nature, goodness. And maybe the world will always be this, half and half almost, or 40-40, with 20% in the middle who you can bring to one side or the other. So all we can do is not spend the majority of our time answering rubbish, Blutzen.
Blutzen.
Blutzen. But have it be water off a duck's back and just breeze past it, answer what you have to answer, but mostly focus, concentrate, give the facts about what's happening to animals, show them the videos, ask them to draw their own conclusion, and appeal to their better side.
Mm-hmm. I'm asking the same question as in the 80s. What were the biggest wins of the 90s? Or did it just grow and grow and people got more aware and that was already a big win?
To me, because it's been almost 40 years, it's the decades are a blur. But one of the biggest wins, which I think was just as the 90s were coming in, was the car crash tests on animals. Mm-hmm. So everybody today, they see a mannequin, a robot in a TV commercial or online, and they don't know it was not always like that. We uncovered the fact that General Motors, for example, but all the car companies except Mercedes, were slamming baboons and pigs into a wall, slam, and just to see head injuries and body injuries. And so we were very vigorous in campaigning against every car company. And finally, the last one was General Motors, was Vauxhall, that gave in. And we then had all car companies in the world using mannequins and robots, and nobody used car crash animals again.
Did the law also kick in here somewhere that it said you can't use animals in those tests?
No, the law never changed, but the companies knew that nobody was going to take it because we were outside auto showrooms, we were at every auto show, we were Initially, we would get people to donate their cars. After we stopped talking and asking for meetings and were ignored, because we always start politely, we escalated and we were demonstrating and still they didn't listen. So then people gave us their old cars and we spray painted them with slogans. We dressed as rabbits and pigs and we smashed them with sledgehammers. And they were getting agitated, but they still did the experiments. So in the end, we were setting fire to the cars outside the auto showrooms. They were our cars. And finally, they thought, where is this going? What's next? And so they stopped. But the law never changed. But the companies knew the bottom line had changed and people weren't going to buy their cars if they did this.
So let's skip already to 2000. Did the actions you take change from the ones from the first 20 years? And if so, how?
Well, we're opportunists because we have to be. We have to look at what's happening in popular culture and try to clue into that. So, yes, there came a time earlier on when we started, I'd rather go naked than wear fur. And that was considered quite extraordinary in America, where nudity is very prudishly regarded. But then after a while, nudity became normal, and then nudity became a bit of a feminist issue. So we've had to move with the times on all of that. But after 9/11, things became very different. When we did things to show people blood and guts and horror, after the Twin Towers were crashed into and America became very defensive, we had to be careful because people wanted comfort. They wanted to see nothing horrible. They wanted only easy answers to things. So we actually took away some of our ads. We had an ad of a woman walking down an alley and a man comes out and bludgeons her to death and steals her coat. This was against the Canada seal slaughter. But suddenly, we just released it. 9/11, we had to withdraw it. People didn't want to see anything like that. So we went more with comforting images of how you can help, how you can make a difference, how you can be kind, how you can have a peaceful, nonviolent diet, peaceful, nonviolent clothing, that kind of thing. Then, of course, things have changed over time. And so now one of my main messages for Peter, through Peter, is if you're against racism, because there's a lot of discussion of this everywhere in the world now, about immigrants and other countries, other cultures, other religions. If you see people as people, and it doesn't matter where in the world they come from, some are good, some are bad, some are indifferent. If you're against racism, then you must be against speciesism. If you're against sexism, you must be against speciesism. So our message is always the same, which is don't be cruel. It's so simple. You know, choose something else. Yeah. But the message delivery changes.
Yeah. Since you mentioned 9/11, I have to think of Jonathan Safran Foer because of his books. I mean, wasn't that extremely loud and incredibly clear or something that was on the, something like that on the attack? But of course, I'm getting towards eating animals. So we have this very popular writer who writes this book. And I think he reached a lot of people. Being vegan became a trend, I would say. How does that feel?
Well, it's good. Yesterday, I was in Berlin. I went to the grocery store. There was a bio market. And there were at least 6 levels of shelving in the refrigerator case where everything from pistachio-flavored luncheon meat to spicy tofu to fake chicken was all vegan. And I walk down the street and there is a Sudanese vegan restaurant. I've never seen one of those before. And there was an Ethiopian vegan restaurant. And there were all these wonderful things, vegan burgers. And that's a big change from a time when no one knew what the word meant. They thought vegan meant you lived in Las Vegas. That's all. So, but I always say to people, as good as that is, remember, it's not just what you put in your mouth. It's what you put on your feet, what you put on your back. Because all the animals used for clothing, not just leather, but the sheep whose wool is taken from them, often in very cruel ways, and people are astonished to hear it's cruel, they become meat. You know, the birds whose feathers are taken, they become meat. Even the crocodiles, when somebody buys an Hermes handbag made from crocodile, those crocodiles are used for meat. So to be vegan is not just not to eat it yourself, but to think of the outside of the animal, all the other uses of the animal. And that is also changing if you look in the clothing store windows.
We just had the German press days where journalists, Instagrammer and so on visit all the PR agencies, and I follow one of, she's a vegan stylist, and she was showing all the possibilities that are there. So definitely a big change happening, yeah.
Leather, for example. I mean, leather is disgusting if you think about it. It's the skin that's stolen from the animal. They have to take the blood and the viscera and everything, scrape it off, and then treat it in formaldehyde or other chemicals that are causing cancer. But now you have leather from pineapples, leather from grapes, leather from everything you can imagine, and it's still leather, but it's cruelty-free. It's just phenomenally fantastic.
Still, we have to think about our environment. I find it really hard to do everything right, because, for example, I love all fake meat, from soy, from lupine, from whatever, and looking into the supermarkets, it's everywhere, which is great, but still, it's everywhere. Just like meat is everywhere and cheap and so on. So we've got a huge overproduction in this world, which is, I think, our biggest enemy, because we're slowly killing the whole earth. How can I be a sustainable vegan in these days?
I am afraid I hate the word sustainable because often it means sustain cruelty. And I always say we don't want to sustain it, we want to stop it. But I know what you mean, of course. You can do the best you can do. But I think the biggest problem is overpopulation of human beings, because everybody wants to sell human beings something. And there are so many human beings. So perhaps at the root cause is trying to get a handle on overpopulation and supporting methods and mechanisms and charities that work to bring choices to women so they don't think that they have to have endless amounts of children to bring into the world. That's one thing. But also packaging. We know about plastics. My heart breaks. I wrote a book called One Can Make a Difference. And in that I talk about, and this book is now a decade old, about the plastics washing up in the Hawaiian Islands. That was going on 10 years ago. It was a huge problem. So for me, the number one thing is the other living beings who share the planet, and that human beings are taking everything over and polluting everything, ruining everything, stealing the land, stealing the very bodies of the animals. So there used to be that expression in the 80s, which I think applies today. Live simply that others may simply live. Mm-hmm. And so, but the big thing is educating others to help us do this. Not just thinking it's enough that we do everything. Do as much as you can, never to be knowingly cruel, and then help somebody else open their eyes and their mind and their heart to this too.
So you mean also be a good influence. Don't be a preaching mean person, because then you would be cruel as well, but maybe show by example how easy it is.
And show by giving, because you can always cook for people, you can shop for people. If someone is having a baby and there's a shower, baby shower party, you can bring things like maybe a little stock, shares in a company that's cruelty-free or vegan. If someone is getting married, you can give them a gift of cruelty-free products, all sorts of things. Everything you do, if you're in an office, bring food and share it. You don't have to preach, but you should tell the truth. And you should be vocal, because the animals, I believe, obviously, they're dead. They can't speak for themselves, and they're being killed. So they can't say anything about that. They depend on us to be their voice, to be their ambassadors, to be their emissaries. So we do have an obligation not to get too comfortable and think, oh, I didn't say anything now, or that won't go. But to say, oh, by the way, I've got this product for you, you might like to try it. Or, oh, actually, I don't eat that because, not just I don't eat it, but I don't eat because I do care about animals, and I found out. I mean, there's no need to be self-righteous, but to say, I found out, because I always thank in my heart everyone who spoke to me and told me something I was doing that I didn't know had a bad repercussion for animals or the earth. So I'm grateful. Maybe at the time I thought, but really, I am so glad in retrospect that they had the fortitude to say, did you know? So if you see somebody doing something and you don't think they know, tell them. Be brave, tell them.
I simply like cooking for friends, for example. So much fun. I do a mean spaghetti bolognese. mean but cruelty-free. How does a day in your life look like?
Oh, it depends where I am and what I'm doing.
Just a very normal day.
A normal day, I'm in a million meetings, brainstorming, trying to find a better way to push a campaign forward, reading the news, finding an opportunity that we could perhaps jump into. And I am always looking for new foods to talk to people about. Everywhere I go, I say something. If I go to the supermarket, I'm in line, I always say, oh, look at this fabulous new product, to the cashier. If I'm in the lift, I always say, to my friend something about, did you know, so that someone else can hear it. I have my magazines, vegan magazines, I leave them in the seat backs of the airplane and the seat backs of the train, in the doctor's office, everywhere, in the hotel. There's always something going on. So it's a busy day wherever I am, because I hope that I'm going to reach some people I didn't even know.
Mm-hmm. I take it not everyone in your friend circle is vegan?
Not everyone is, but they know they should be. And I call them pre-vegans because they have enough information that I just know they're going to change. And one of my friends cared very deeply about dogs. And he met me because he found a dog who was hit by a car on the highway at night, late. And he couldn't find anybody to help him. And eventually he came to me afterwards, 2 days later, and said, I want to start an answering service so people can always know wherever they are the quickest way to get help for an injured animal. But he made fun of me because he wasn't vegetarian, he wasn't vegan, he fished, he was a gun nut, and so on. And I worked on him for a long time. He died a few years ago. He had raised his son vegan. He had done videos about veganism. He no longer fished. And it was just wonderful. And I thought, if Mike can change, anyone can change. Never give up. Because we joked, we laughed. We even went to a rock club together sometimes to listen to music. And he would tease me, and I never let it get me down. I always said, you know you're wrong, Mike. Because, and then I would give him a fact. And in the end, he couldn't deny it. He changed.
I'm a huge fan of stories like that, because I have to think of my own parents and what an influence I am. And I see they're having the typical diseases that you get from eating way too much meat and so on. And they started being aware. And I like that. sometimes it's hard because my brother is very narrow-minded and he's like a little troll, a living troll sitting across from me on the table, and then the other two, they're actually listening, which is nice.
Parents are very difficult. Sometimes a family is the hardest to change, and that shouldn't be upsetting. It's just a fact. Your family usually doesn't listen to you very closely. But I find that when my father and mother were alive, I made great inroads by showing them the physician's committee information. So I would give them books that weren't from me, but that were from a doctor about nutrition. My father had heart problems, and so I gave him that kind of information. And for my mother, who was very kind, but she grew up cooking for my father because that was the generation that did that, then I gave her alternative meats and things that Daddy would like. If you put them into a lasagna or you put them into a, you know, sausage or something, he wouldn't even know, because he would sit at the table and eat. And if it was tasty, he ate it. You know, he never went into the kitchen. So that worked. And because she was kind, I showed her films like Earthlings. Mm. And that had a great impact on her, because it didn't come just from me. It came from these other people and this media and these movie people and these book people, and that had an influence. But families are difficult.
Yeah. Ich wollte meinen Eltern immer Forks over Knives zeigen, weil es halt einfach super wissenschaftlich ist. You understood, I wanted to show my parents Forks over Knives because it's very scientific, you know, and definitely in this age group, my dad is as your year, has an impact, I guess, because they still want to live, and I want them to live too. Mm-hmm. Well, since we're talking about living parents and diseases, there's one line. It says das Gruseltestament. I read it in a yellow press. Your testament.
Oh, my will, my last will and testament. Yes, that's great fun. But it started out very seriously, because I was almost in a plane crash. Mm-hmm. And I was coming into Norfolk, Virginia, where our headquarters is. It was a very stormy night. We didn't know that every other plane had diverted. But we were on a small plane with two cowboy pilots, young men, who decided they wanted to try this. And pilots have discretion. I also didn't know that till afterwards. When you looked down out of the window, it was pitch black with lightning and the skies lit up with red flashes. And I thought, we're not going into that. But we were. And as we went down, we were caught in wind shear. Mm. It was like being in a tumble dryer. And then deathly silence. Everybody was first screaming. Then deathly silence. The plane had been shaking. Then nothing for 20 minutes. I found out afterwards we had gone out over the ocean and we had found a calm place. The pilots were scrambling to find another place to land the plane because a tornado had been coming up the coast headed towards us and we had been caught in the tornado wind. So then we were going down again after about 20 minutes. He found a new airport. But again, we were caught in wind shear. And the whole plane, it felt as if it was coming apart. Everybody thought they were going to die. Well, obviously, we didn't die, because the third airport we landed. We had tried to land at an Air Force base. And we finally landed with very little fuel. And afterwards, we all got to know each other on the plane, and we all had our stories of what we were thinking about. But I was thinking, first, isn't this wonderful that Peter has so many great staff who know what they're doing, and they probably won't miss me. This is wonderful. But the second thing I was thinking is, oh no, that my activism is going to be over. This is the end of my activism for animals. I have to do something else for animals. And the next day, sitting in a meeting, you get this feeling that you shouldn't be there. People say that always happens after a near-death experience. But I thought, you know, If my body had survived that, I could have cut it up into little pieces, and I could use each piece after I'm dead to do something good, to carry on protests and campaigning. So I made my will, and I divided up different parts of my body, and that's what will happen if the body is intact.
Mm-hmm.
I won't need my body when I'm gone. Nobody else will need it. I asked my mother, who was alive then, I thought, what do you think? Is that okay? She said, of course. I'm not religious in that I don't need any ritual done over my body, but I'll have a liver, and some part of my liver can go to France to protest foie gras, where they force feed the ducks and the geese until their livers almost burst, sometimes do burst. My ears will go to Canada if the Canada seal slaughter is still on, so that the government, I can say, maybe my ears can help you hear the cries of the baby seals. And so on, little bits of it will be divided up and used. I won't need it. But my most exciting part is that I want my flesh to be barbecued with onions and garlic, and I want people to smell it cooking and come over and say, oh, what is that? And someone will say, it's her. And then they'll think, oh no. But it will tell them it smells the same. It tastes the same. It's all flesh. We are all sisters under the skin.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be my last question. What do you wish for this world?
Kindness.
Das kann man genauso stehen lassen. Ich sag Dankeschön, es war ein super interessantes Gespräch. Schön, dass du die Zeit gefunden hast. I say thank you. It was super exciting, amazing stories. So thanks for your time.
Thank you for doing it.
Was für ein Gespräch. Ich bin immer noch begeistert von dem, was Ingrid Newkirk schon alles gemacht hat, vor allem bewegt hat in Sachen Tierrechte. Ich hoffe, euch hat es auch gefallen. Empfiehlt diesen Podcast doch einfach mal weiter an Freunde und Bekannte, die gern wissen möchten, warum ihr so hinterher seid, Tiere zu schützen. Ich bin Gesine Kühne und das hier ist der Peter-Podcast.